Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's April 7th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I hope you guys who are trying to listen in didn't have too much difficulty, but it was my fault. I had somehow forgotten to input the broadcast, so I freaked out at the last moment when I realized it wasn't posted. Unbelievable. Well, anyway, thank goodness the person who is the highlight of today's broadcast is none other than New York State Assembly Member Nader Sayers. He represents District 90, the Assembly District 90, which in entirety is about 85% of the city of Yonkers. So good morning, sir. How are you? And I'm sorry for my blunder here this morning.
Good morning, Hezzy. Pleasure to be back on the show. And, today is truly a special day. And I didn't realize that, as we wish all our friends a joyous holiday, it's been like 33 years until, the three major religions have holidays during the same period.
Yes.
Don't realize, but Christians are celebrating today Good Friday, and Easter is upcoming with Eastern Orthodox, the Jewish holiday of Passover, and the Muslim holiday of Ramadan. So it's really those moments where we have everybody celebrating together. So a joyous and a healthy to everyone listening.
Well, you would think that with this propitious moment where everything is aligned, that people would be aligned, but we're still not. I wonder when we're going to get it together, because there's so much animosity and so much, bias against one another. And we still haven't figured out how to get along. And I don't know where the loss of, respect or admiration of others is, or if it's just, believing that one is better than the other, whoever the other is. And we seem to have all sorts of definitions on how to create that. But I wonder if it's the way we raise our children, that they don't understand that everyone's equal.
Yeah, and people don't realize how much commonality human nature and human beings have to each other, and whatever the difference is very minor. But you're right, our nation, our state, our community, the last decade, we've seen a tremendous amount of polarization and division, and you're right, to the level where it's even beyond politics, where years ago, candidates ran against each other, but at the end of the day, people were elected to office, and the pledge was to represent everyone. And as time went on, people respected the position. People respected, the concept of, you represent everyone, and you try to either legislate or follow up on initiatives that are, in my opinion, mainstream, that really try to serve the benefits of the majority. But today, the polarization has developed into this almost hate level. You look at New York and you look at the politics even surrounding, an indictment of an ex-president, and you look at the turmoil from both ends. People that feel, the law is the law and you got to abide by it. But then the other end, you can understand, hey, you go to a forum that's totally unfair. You go to a forum where legislation is largely used for the first time to indict someone. It looks very political. And what that does is really put fuel into that division. And, and I speak as a Democrat, but I really think on that front, it was a mistake. I think all we did is we gave more ammunition to someone that I thought should have been retired, at the end result, he's become a front runner for his party nomination as a result of the indictment and this you know, public relations situation going on. But that's politics.
Well, that's very true, because I think today, and that's what makes you so unique, is that you don't look at things from a particular prism that is specific to one group or another, to one people who may be of one complexion or another, or of a particular religion or another, because at the end, if you decipher it all to the baseline, we're all human beings. We may be of different color, of different religions, of different likes, of different wants, of different sexuality, of different definitions of who we are. But at the end, we need you to be in the political realm, because you go beyond that and you say, well, these are human beings, and what is it that they need? So do they need diapers because they're old and they can't hold their bodily fluids in check? Do they need some sort of capacity to go to school, and they don't have the funding for it? So this is the beauty of the way you look at things. You go beyond all that bias and bigotry, and you go for the bottom line, the baseline, you know, and that's what defines us.
I'm a lifelong educator, and I'm an attorney.
Exactly.
I'm a businessman as an attorney. You know, and politics to me is really a calling, you know, to do whatever you can, utilize your experience, your emotions, and really try to reflect on, you know, what the needs are and what's fair, what's equitable, what's the proper way to handle. And you're right, even though I may have a banner as a candidate or as an office holder with the Democrat Party line, I've always considered myself, you know, always to be mainstream, because when you're mainstream, you're able to look at what I consider the needs of the majority of the people we live with and we represent.
Mm-hmm.
And I, it's because even at the state capitol, you know, I often have issues with sometimes the policies or the positions taken by, you know, the Democrat Party. And I say this openly, and I hate my colleagues whenever I feel, you know, the discussion goes too much to the left or too much to the right. And I've learned, you know, to understand the full picture of each issue. For example, you know, when the debate went on with regards to bail reform, you know, I took the position, hey, the concept of bail reform made a lot of sense, where for something where two individuals, a minor crime, then you shouldn't go to jail because you can't afford $250. And I go to my family, I go to my job because I can afford it. Yeah, that's an equity issue. But then when judges start coming to us and saying, hey, you took away our discretion to keep violent or repeat offenders off the street, it's a concern. Nobody wants to be assaulted. Nobody wants, God forbid, someone to get raped or someone to get hurt or murdered. And therefore, our society is such where, you know, you definitely need a deterrent. You need to make sure individuals know you do the crime, you're going to do the time. And, you know, and having said that, I'm the biggest advocate for try to do preventive and try to deal with mental illness and try to make sure schools have support services and benefits so that we don't need to get to that point. But to say, well, you know, let's get rid of jails altogether, and if somebody commits a crime, it's okay because blame society, and therefore let's just make sure we give the person treatment. You know, you're taking away the deterrence. And what happens with victim rights? You know, to go to someone with a minor issue and to say put in jail because or you were held accountable for using drugs or whatever, but we want to help you. Yeah, there's what we have, diversion courts, where, you know, the judges have the right to have treatment available for the individual. And as an alternative to jail, you know, that's fine. You know, there's certain levels of let's work with the individual, let's try to prepare them to get back into the world, to get back into, you know, job development and preparation for life. But to say, let's get rid of the concept of jails is really something that, you know, in my opinion, wasn't fair. And when individuals were, if you recall, and still going into major outlets and stores and feeling that, hey, I can come in, nobody can question me, I can steal whatever I want, you know, and people were sometimes saying, well, you know, it's okay, it's a minor crime, but what if somebody repeatedly goes into the same place where now it's become so serious where they're putting businesses out of business, where people are closing their shops and closing major chains, then it becomes out of order. So then that's the type of area where, you know, I supported legislation that makes it very, very difficult for someone to repeatedly steal from a business to think, well, it's a minor, I'll go in, the judge will let me out, and I'll go steal again. You had individual gangs that were going into businesses, you know, outright. Nobody can question me, and they take, you know, God knows, thousands of products off shelves and just walk out. And if they're arrested, out on the street again, and they do it again. So the new laws make it with stiffer crimes, where now they're felonies for repeat offenders. And if you assault someone that works in a business or a store, you know, to me, they're first responders. They're heroes. During the pandemic, we honored not only healthcare and firemen and police, but all these local store owners or bodega owners, or, you know, these are individuals that, you know, without them being on the front line serving us food and serving us whatever our needs are, or being able to go buy that gallon of milk or my diapers or whatever my needs are, these are individuals that, you know, risk their life being on the front line. So should they be assaulted and insulted?
But I got to ask you, why is it that we need to somehow preach even to the judges of what they should do? What is so difficult about this? I mean, is it the politics that we play today that they can't understand the rationale behind even the laws? And that need to be revised and revised over and over again until they get it. And these are not dummies. These are people with high intellect and with educational backgrounds that would put them at the top of the pinnacle somehow. But somehow they don't get it.
Well, some people feel that it's a fault of society. You know, and to some extent, the part of it, and again, as an educator, the part of it that I can say fault of the system may be that, you know, we don't put enough emphasis on making sure there's enough support services to prevent that we develop job development and make college accessible for all individuals and make sure that even at the local level of public education, that there's always enough counselors and guidance counselors and psychologists and social workers. You know, people sometimes lose the significance of having a proper level of support services. Kid is 8 years old or in middle school or high school, and they have emotional or social disabilities or emotional concerns. These issues need to be addressed immediately. So when you have a social worker, a psychologist that is assigned to 1,200 kids. Now, you know and I know, Hezzy, there's no way in the world that psychologist can in any way properly address the concerns. So when you leave these issues unattained or undealt with for too long and problems become more severe, then that child is going to drop out of school. That child is going to resort to wrong conduct and often drug addiction or alcohol, and eventually to some extent that it's to crime. And then, you
know,
you got
to do... You're right, but that's a reality. But is there a way... Well, I guess there are a lot of issues here. So the financial needs in order to appease this circumstance that may happen, the lack of teachers, the lack of parental guidance. How do we bring all these different facets together? And are we all responsible, or do we expect the state to take care of everything? I mean, I'm sure you were raised by your family. They raised you the way you are. That makes you unique. But they also gave you everything. And then you became something special because of it. Not everybody has that background. I'm blessed to have been afforded, you know, my life because my parents, you know, they took an interest. And there are a lot of families that don't. Their children literally survive on the streets on their own.
Well, you're right.
It's
not
amazing.
Money. Oh, you're right. I mean, I grew up eight siblings, right? Eight of us, and lost other young. But you know, we didn't have money. We grew up as an immigrant family in Southwest Yonkers, and I often say the story. It used to shine shoes downtown Yonkers by the waterfront to pay my school. So when somebody tells me you don't understand, I said, truly, I understand. Whether it's I felt with it all, you know, and I tell the story sometimes to let someone know, hey, you know, you gotta have an upbringing where, and you're right. A lot of times that's the fault. You know, money isn't the answer. You look at the state budget. We're still negotiating. We got to go back to Albany Monday. And the biggest issue, I mean, money, there's a lot of money in the state budget. You're talking about $232 billion in New York state budget. So, you know, there's a full amount of funds for education and healthcare and mental illness. You know what the stumbling block is, you know, to get in the budget signed on time? It's a debate on bail reform. You and I were just talking about bail reform, and that seems to be the biggest stumbling block that is delaying. Money isn't even the issue. Money, there's enough money in the budget where if money was the only issue, 90% of the lobbyists and the advocates and people would probably be happy and say, hey, yeah, the state addressed our budgetary needs. But the debate going on deals with issues and policies, you know, with the bail reform and the housing compact initiative we'll talk about. I mean, these are two really, in my opinion, social issues, social agendas, and you have people that strongly one way or the other on both sides. And I look at it and I say, you know, there's a common ground with bail reform, with housing initiatives, common ground that goes to the needs of the majority of New Yorkers, the majority of the people we represent. You know, with bail reform again, people that take the position that any changes to bail reform is a weakness, my attitude, nonsense. It's not a weakness. Mm-hmm. If you have a good initiative, you got a good program, let's fine-tune it. Let's fix it. Let's find out where the flaws are. And if the judges are saying to us, we don't have discretion to keep the violent criminals off the street, then you know what? I'm going to put on my educator hat on and see. Let's fine-tune. If we got to spell it clearly, A, B, C, D, we got to make it so clear and say, hey, judges, here's the policy, here's the law, this is how you can keep that violent criminal or that repeat offender off the street. And
fascinating what you're saying is that unfortunately we have a lot of people who get into politics because they want to be politicians. They find it somehow attractive, but they don't bring the skills that are required to be someone who can distill the issues of society and to contend with them, and has the discipline in their educational background to say, from a legal perspective, this is what we need to do. From an educational perspective, this is what we need to do. From a humanitarian perspective, this is what we need to do, and this is what we need to tell the people who come before us in a court of law, so that they can be forewarned at what the ramifications are if they don't comply. And so it's like the recidivism will stop or be lessened to a great extent. We need people with knowledge, education-wise, humanitarian-wise, you know, also we also need people who speak different languages, who can appreciate the different people that are out there. We're not homogeneous anymore. This is not America where everybody speaks English.
No, we're a diversified community. Got to respect everyone.
Exactly.
Feel part of the fabric of our government, of our community, our business. When everybody is involved and everybody feels, hey, I have a stake in this. I have a, you know, I have a role to play. You know, people feel better about themselves, you know, about their families, about their ethnicities or race. And that's what, when we preach opportunity, equality, diversity, you know, people say, oh, they're only words. They're not really words. If you really try, as you said, to be fair, to be open-minded, to be, you know, to be reasonable with regards to whatever role you play. If you're a businessman and you're doing development, yes, you know, of course, you want to make sure if you're investing your money in a project, whether it's building housing or whatever, yes, you know, there should be a compromise where, hey, we know there's an affordable housing issue, so I'm going to pledge that 10% of the units I'm going to build or more, you know, is going to go to affordable housing. Or I'm going to pledge to give back to my community, like we're trying to arrange now with MGM, you know, when they get their table license. You know, we're talking to them and saying, hey, you're going to play a major role and you're going to make a lot of money. Not only does the state benefit from taxes, the school system would benefit, you know, from lump sum payments yearly, but also the economics of it, of how many jobs would be developed, how many good paying jobs, and how can this business give back to the community, whether it's IBM, whether it's Xerox, or, you know, whatever businesses. Now we have all the studios doing movies in Yonkers, you know, and, you know, Great Point Studio and Lionsgate. We're negotiating with them. We're reaching out and saying, hey, you know, as a business, we recognize that as a business, of course, you're in the business of making money. You're in the business of expanding and growing. You can't take that away in our society from people that are investing. But at the same time, let's talk about how you can give back to your community. How can the movie industry not only pay more taxes for Yonkers, where we can keep property taxes down, we can provide more fire services, police, education, all that fits in. So you need, as a legislator, whether on the local, county, state, or federal, to always look at the needs and how do you try to bring the parties together. How do you sometimes negotiate? How do you mediate? You know, with housing, the governor, you know, to her credit, recognized that, hey, New York State, you know, we're trying to develop jobs and bring back the economy, but we need more affordable housing. She's right. And then she made a pledge recently where her administration during the next decade would focus on making sure there is 800,000 new units of affordable housing. So great. Then whether it's wrong advice, put out a plan where now you're trying to take away the rights of local community with regards to zoning regulation. And when this came out last year, I was one of the main players that put a stop to it. I went to the sponsors and said, look, the concept promoting more affordable housing is a good concept, but let's work together with municipalities, with counties, where if the state wants to see an increase of 3% of affordable housing in a city, let's say like Yonkers or the county. Let's work with the administrations, and I'm sure most of them would welcome, especially if there's going to be incentives to address infrastructure problems. When you build more housing, you need more fire services, you need more schools, you need more, you know, water treatment developments, you need more central piping and sewage and so forth. People don't realize the cost affiliated with a growing community. When you're a community of 100,000 and then, you know, 10 years later, you're at 125,000, you have 25,000 people that now you got to continue as a government to provide services for. And that's where some foresight, you know, to see, you know, what are the issues. When the housing compact came and it looked like it was geared to put in, let's say, a lot of additional housing in single zone neighborhoods. And we know from our experience in Yonkers, a lot of people that many of them as immigrants that worked hard and bought a home in a single zone neighborhood because they wanted a quiet life, a light atmosphere, you know, were totally upset with, you know, trying to integrate multiple housing that impacts parking, impacts the quality of life. So there was upfront a lot of opposition, rightfully so. And I took a stand to say, wait a minute, affordable housing initiatives are good, but you got to work with municipalities. You got to work with the system in place. If you need to make some modification, let's work on it. Let's try to come up with a system, a process that promotes affordable housing with the cooperation and the support of all the parties involved. But when you go in...
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because there were issues like that. I know the mayor from Bronxville, Mayor Marvin, she was livid when she heard that, because every community is a little different, and it has a demeanor and a flavor and a taste, and not everything is on a socioeconomic level.
No, it's not.
Bronxville is a very wealthy community in comparison to others, but the point is they have a cohesiveness and an ability and a definition of who they are and what they want and what they've strived for, and it didn't happen overnight. This has been going on for hundreds of years. You know, we need to respect all of this at the same time as we try to build affordable housing and be more inclusive, because our populations are changing and our capacity, education and earning capacity is very different than what it was even 50 years ago.
No, it is.
That's where we need to learn.
You know, with housing, for example, you know, and for people, the Yonkers, for example, they know, and practically, you know, 2/3 of the city, right? There's so many two-family homes with in-laws, with attics, with attachments. In those type of settings, right? Times have changed. Yeah. Years ago, when an immigrant family had a two-family with an in-law, generally, there were large families back then. You know, the average was 6 to 10 people in the family. So they usually used the first floor in the basement as one unit, right? And, you know, they had enough bedrooms. But as times changed and, you know, that population evolved and the husband and wife, for example, you know, became older and God forbid somebody, you know, one spouse was lost and the kids all moved out. Then, you know, that property is their bread and butter. You know, that's what they put their life in investments in. So now they don't need that unit. So that unit, a lot of times, honestly, from what I see, people are renting them out, even though they're technically illegal, you know, but they're forced to rent to a single person, to a nurse, a doctor, a student, you know, which addresses the housing need problem. So this legislation by the governor, if it's done the proper way, can legalize those apartments. And everybody's going to be happy, because once you legalize them, there's an enhanced tax benefit. The landlord or the property owner have to worry about annual inspections, and every time someone from the city comes, oh, I got to remove the stove and I got to remove the sink, and then once it passes inspection, then I can re-rent it. Let's legalize it. This way, you know, we can we can address housing insecurity, right? We can make it affordable. We can enhance the tax base. But that's where, you know, the reasonable thinking comes in, where you can see the goodness of a policy, but say, you know what, part of it doesn't work, or part of it would cause a lot of issues. How do we fix it so that we can move on? Yonkers, for example.
We got to ask, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, look at Yonkers, and you go up and down the waterfront, and you look at how much housing has been built the last 10 years. You know, and some of it, and I've attended the groundbreaking, I've attended, you know, the opening of these facilities. Many of them were totally affordable housing. And so a city like Yonkers, where during the last decade, you know, it has increased to a population of some 215,000, we're now the third largest city in the state. So Yonkers, there were advocates that were upset. They wanted any new developments to have 20% affordable housing, right? The present number that they work with is 10%. So, you know, and try to explain to people, look, when you go to investors and their attitude is, look, we can live with 10%. If you force us to do 20%, then the way the financial incentives work, you know, as far as building these housing, then it takes them out of the market. And their attitude is, if you're going to force me to do 20%, you know what? I'm going to go elsewhere and build elsewhere. I'm going to build in Jersey and Pennsylvania and Carolina, whatever. And we lose that housing and that investment. So I try to tell the advocates, look, do you want 10% of 1,000 units, or do you want 20% of zero units? You know, so when you look at it that way, people say, you know, you're right. I'd rather have housing built. You know, sometimes it's like, you know, I want 50% of nothing, but you're offering me 10% of you know, X amount of dollars. So you got to
I just want you to know though that the thing that's so wonderful about talking with you is because a lot of people don't recognize the arithmetic, and they think, well, 20% is better than 10%, and they don't realize that the equation falls on the developer, and that if it's not affordable to the developer, they're not going to be developing at all. So you get zero. You get absolutely nothing. But that's what people don't comprehend.
Oh, yeah. But I spoke to a number of developers during that debate, and I said, look, you know, they're talking 10%, and the other side is talking 20%. So when you negotiate and you do it in a reasonable way and you say, look, guys, you know, what can you live with? I mean, if we have to increase it a little bit, you know, and they would come back and say, you know what, if they propose, you know, let's go up to 13, 14%, you know, maybe we can live that. So I look at the other side and say, look, I mean, what are you doubling the amount from 10 to 20? I mean, that's being a little bit unreasonable. Look at the economic factors and the loss and so forth. And they say, well, you know, we're trying to get the full amount. That's negotiation. You know, everybody starts at a point, and the whole beauty of negotiation is, you know, you negotiate where everybody walks off the table and that's something.
But isn't what you're explaining, is that a lot of people take a political perspective because they think whoever is espousing this, the 20%, for example, they think that that will fly. It will fly with their constituents. However, it doesn't fly at all because it never comes about, because it's not affordable. And then how could people who are living on where their rent is very low, and then if they're building a new development and they give 20% and the rates go through the roof, what's it going to do to their value? And will they be able to afford to even live there, even if they have an affordable housing unit right now? Because everything's going to rise up. Because who's going to be able to afford to buy the food from the restaurants and to buy the food from the supermarkets and all the other stuff that's going to matter? You know, people don't look at it that way, and there's a great deal of complexity. And that's the problem, because we have people who look at it from a political perspective rather than a economic level, where it will either make sense or not make sense. And that's the failure of many of our people who are in elected office. Not everybody,
right.
Don't get me wrong. And may not even be the majority. But the point is, those that are on the wrong path should stop it.
Well,
you're
know,
leading the way in a good way. You're giving us a rationale and an understanding.
Legislation is often recognized in needs. And recently,
yes,
at the state level, I sponsored a new legislative piece, a bill, Assembly Bill 3728. And all of us have recognized, you know, the ongoing crisis, you know, with shootings, mass shootings at schools, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And about a week ago when I was in Albany, there was even a day when there was forced alarms all over schools throughout New York State, even at Gordon High School in Yonkers. You know, there was a flood false active shooter reports statewide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frustrating and it's annoying, you know, especially in light of a few weeks ago with the mass shooting in Tennessee. Six people were killed, three of them kids. I mean, it's really upsetting. And, you know, me, I look at it as a public official. I look at it as an educator. You know, what's going on in our schools? What are we doing? What are we not doing to better protect our kids and our staff and teachers and parents? I wrote legislation that now is gaining momentum. It addresses what I consider not only New York State, but even nationally to be a crucial area that needs to be addressed. And that is the establishment of a standard, a school standard for safety and security. Too often, you know, we just allow districts and schools to have their own plans in place. And honestly, some of them, you know, and I've been involved where I set security systems at schools I was principal at. And I made sure that there was adequate staff to protect kids in schoolyards, to make sure doors are all locked in properly. You know, but this requires a whole system in place. So this legislation that I introduced, and already people are co-sponsoring with me because they said, hey, this is real, this is urgent, this addresses a crisis,
right.
You know, support this legislation. And, you know, it's amazing how something that is so big of a crisis, you know, that you need to look at it closely and say, hey, you know, do we have a standard? Do we have a security system in place where, you know, every school district, whether it's the principals and staff or the board of trustees or whomever, do they have a system in place that A, B, C, D clearly describes, whether on a continuous basis, a checklist, to make sure this is what that school has in place to protect our kids? And we demanded that the Division of Homeland Security, the New York State Police, the Commissioner of Education work together to establish the security and safety standard. And that's something that I'm proud of, you know, that I use my prior experience and knowledge of what it takes to safeguard kids in a school. And we put forth the legislation. And also, I got calls from people from New Jersey, legislators that are saying, hey, we love what you did in New York. We want to sponsor this in Jersey. So I'm looking at it and saying, hey, well, I often said sometimes the best legislative initiatives come out of New York State, you know, because we happen to be a very progressive type of state, legislation that's real, that's practical, that's necessary, and people tie into it. You know, there's no disagreement, even on the state level. The Republican colleagues I spoke to.
Yeah, well, because it goes beyond politics. It goes beyond Democrat or Republican or a third party. Or Republican and Democrat, whatever way you want to look at it. The point is, though, you're bringing the experience and your innovation when you were an educator, when you were a teacher, when you were a principal of a school. So you were able to incorporate these things because you knew what was going wrong. And then you can ameliorate them. But that's the problem today. We have people who just want the job because they want the power. They want the honor of saying, well, I'm an assembly member or I'm a senator, but they don't have the capacity to deliver. They just can sit there and pontificate about nothing because they don't know how to put A to B to C to D and create a panoply of mechanisms that will work. And that's the difference between you and others. And that's what we don't see quite often.
No, you don't.
And we don't often hear our politicians telling us why and what the rationale is for their conduct. That's the beauty of talking to you, because any rational person can say, hey, that's who they are. This is where they grew up. This is how they grew up. This is what they were able to do for themselves. They pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps. Their parents demanded it of them, and they delivered because there was no other option. And now you have a stellar reputation based on your experience. And there are very few people that can hold a candle to that. You know that.
Well,
you know the people that you have to work with up in Albany.
Well, you know what? We're in trouble.
Not everyone is bad. There are a lot of good people.
There's a lot of good people. And even with this plan, I've had representatives tell me, well, you know, in my school district, we got an excellent plan. And my answer is, of course, there's a lot of school districts, a lot of schools that are doing things. But, you know, what this legislation does is goes out, you know, with the collaboration of all entities and gets the best practices. So when we have, you know, an opportunity to see what works at your school and my school and this district and that district, and we say, well, what do you have in place? Let me see your safety security plan. Let me see your emergency evacuation plan. Let me see what you do at the start of every school year on a regular basis to check, you know, whatever is considered to be a safety concern. Something as simple as making sure every door locks, making sure that they lock properly. I know as a principal, and I addressed it years ago, that sometimes staff members, you know, would keep a door open to the parking lot, right, with park in case someone forgets something in their car, they want to go back out. They come late a little bit and they want to come in right away. But keeping that door open, you know, is really a danger because then you're inviting anyone to walk through. So policies that strictly make sure every door locks, making sure that there's a strict policy that, you know, every staff member as well as parents or repair people or anybody must use the front entrance. You know, of course, emergencies happen, but in general, you can't have these doors from the side of schools or parking lot left open and people can come in and out when they want. You know, that's inviting trouble. And therefore, you know, initiative.
You know, all these things really do matter, but they're only based on knowing what you're talking about, what you do. You know, but again, this is like the flavor of the month. Everyone's talking about security now. The issue was also evidenced 5 years ago, but maybe there were less people with guns, or I don't know what happened, so that there now is more atrocities taking place where people have some sort of, anger against a particular school or whatever, so they go berserk. But there's so many other issues that we don't focus on. You know, like, there are kids that should be attending our school, whether it be in Yonkers or other places, and yet they don't attend. And yet they get passed along from one grade to the next. When they never graduated, they never even show up in school. Why do we permit that? Because what we're doing is we're making believe that things are okay, but on the other hand, they're not okay because the people that are supposedly coming to school are on the streets. And they don't know anything. They don't even have a means to support themselves other than to commit the robberies, which creates a situation where if you go to a Walgreens or some other drugstore, everything is locked up behind plexiglass. It's ridiculous what we've
done.
People
don't, you know, we have major branches of, you know, retail businesses that are closing shops, Walgreens and Rite Aids, and, you know, they're closing shops, Walmart, and, you know, their staff are telling us, hey, you know, we can't do a thing. People are kind of, you know what the difference is, Hezzy? And I said this to legislators that said, you know, if somebody feels, why punish? And I said, let me tell you something. Years ago, the norm was that if somebody went in to steal milk or bread or food they needed for their family or steal diapers or, you know, things that were basic because they needed them, honestly, you know, the old days of Robert Hood, you know, we take the position that, okay, it's wrong conduct, but you feel bad for someone that really needed something and they got to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But the new breed of criminals, you know, that are going in not because they need that loaf of bread. They're going there to steal 20 iPads or they're going to steal, you know, medicine or other items that, you know, they would go back on the street and sell them. That's different. That's criminal conspiracy. That's criminal. That the motive there isn't because I'm hungry and I need and I'm forced to go and steal. That type of conduct that's become so widespread where people are walking into malls, you know, and just robbing outright and basically looking at store owners and managers and staff members and saying, don't bother me, don't touch me. Because, you know, there's harassment, there's threats, and there's assault, and sometimes, in some cases, people are murdered. When I spoke to business people, especially in the Bronx, and I know some of them, and some of them have lost members of their staff and family as a result of vandalism and fights and assault, you know, when they tell you, look, you know, the same person that you may call the cops, and then they're arrested, and then, you know, hours later, they're back on the street looking at you and threatening you like, how are you next time? I want to walk in, steal what I want, and don't open your mouth. I mean, if we've become a society that allows this to this level, it's ridiculous. And I try to
argue. Is that our fault? Is that not our fault? Because we don't demand that not only the parents, who are probably trying the best that they can, but their kids see a different way of making a buck. But they can't be, if they were in school, if they were forced to know that there is no leniency and that if we throw you in jail for some sort of horrendous crime, then the bottom line is you're not coming out. It's not going to be a revolving door. So parents need to be responsible for their kids. Kids need to be responsible for the kids. And our institutions like our schools need to demand that these kids come to school and they need to pass the test. And if they don't pass the test, we need to do something about these. It used to be like that 50 years ago.
We lost a lot of that value system, that cultural heritage, that holy values. And you're right. I mean, you know, we can look and say, There's a lot of issues, you know, that are the fault of, you know, the system or society and the ethics and the fairness. But to a large extent, we got to start pushing back on blaming everything on society. And we got to start really encouraging whether groups or organizations or segments of the society to take some responsibility for, you know, their doing. To really start, whether it's through the religious organizations or civic organizations or, you know, promoting more of what we consider, people say, the old times, but it's not the old times. This is the traditional way where a family structure, a community structure, takes some responsibility with its children, its family. And sometimes, you know, I understand with broken families, you know, uncles and aunts and grandparents get involved. We got to bring back some of that where, it takes a village to raise a child. You know, it may sound like, well, does it really make sense? But it really makes sense. You know, it does take a village, but, you know, we've lost a lot of that where, you know, everybody is so self-centered. We lost the system where even among family members, the siblings, where if my brother's lost, I just got to worry about myself and let him be lost. You know, we lost that system where everybody feels a sense of responsibility to try to hold on to whatever, you know, promotes stability, whether in their families or their homes, community. And is that easy? No, it's not easy, Hezzy. But you know what? Maybe the fact that I are talking about it hopefully would send a message for the listening audience and others that, look, you know, when it comes to talking about issues or concerns, a lot of it sometimes starts from within our own homes, our own gatherings, our own, you know, network, who we hang out with, who we socialize with. And parents got to understand, you know, monitor what your kids do. You know, if you see unusual behavior, I mean, we often say that. Don't look the other way and make believe it doesn't exist, because now, even with drug addiction, how many young people are dying because now they're put in fentanyl, which is a deadly, deadly combination with heroin or cocaine. They're putting that in the medication, in the drugs. And these young kids are taking them, and there isn't even time. Sometimes it's minutes where even if you notice somebody's at it and you call for help, Very often it's too late. Recently, where was it? Here in Westchester, we had in New Rochelle, four young people, I think three died, young people, overdose of fentanyl. You know, that's what's upsetting, that, you know, we've allowed this to continue and grow. And, you know, and our family structure has deteriorated so much where, you know, whether it's protecting our kids or, you know, looking the other way, you know, we got to speak up. We got to take an active role.
Well,
we got to honor.
We need to do that from a family perspective, but also, you know, our police departments, I don't know if they're stopping the fentanyl from coming into the districts. That's a problem too. So you really have to wonder what the direction is of a particular police department. Not every department is exactly like that. But the point is, if it's a porous society, then you have to deal with it. Because those are the issues.
Well,
we just don't want to deal with it. And it becomes like, oh, we're going to call the police department some derogatory term. They're not derogatory. The point is they have a different environment in each different community. It's different in Bronxville than it is from Yonkers, than it is from New Rochelle, than it is from Mount Vernon, than it is from New York City or the Bronx or Manhattan or Brooklyn or Queens, whatever. You know, it's a different environment. But then we have to jump to that. And we should demand more of our parents as well. Like you said, it's responsibility. We can't impose it after the fact. You know, they've got to learn. And the ramifications if you don't.
We've become too much of a reaction society where even with fentanyl and drug usage, you know, my office even, you know, did a Narcan training not too long ago. And a lot of people came. The state got involved. We gave out these kits that, you know, once you spray in the nostril, a couple of sprays, you know, save a life, something as simple as that, we gave out these kits to a lot of people that attended. They had certificates of attendance. But the problem is, you know, we can't stay reactionary. That's the problem. You know, we're talking about, yes, address the concerns, and sometimes you got to be reactionary, but try to go back core of what's causing these problems. And you're right, is law enforcement,
that is the problem. The core problem here is that some people are taking drugs illegally. They shouldn't be doing so. You can give them the Narcan to save their lives, but are they going to go back the next day to do exactly the same thing? Is their life worth anything, or is it worth nothing? And don't they have to make that decision? And if we're giving all these ways to ameliorate these problems, when are they going to stop? Or are they going to keep going back and back all the time to get the Narcan in the hope that they can go through whatever, I don't know what sort of high you get from taking these drugs, but whatever the case is, it's a real problem. And it also, quite often, the fentanyl could be on people's bodies, and when the police come in or the fire department come in or hospital crews come in, they can get infected from it too because it's on the clothing.
It's very dangerous. And it's such a small amount, and the danger of it is unbelievable. And, you know, we're losing a lot of young people, and, you know, but you're right. You know, my concern is how come we're not able to monitor where these drugs are coming from? How come we're not putting the effort to put a stop to
it? We are able to do it. The point is that we don't have an interest in doing it. If we did, we would stop it. You know, for example, they talk about like cigarette taxes. You know how much cigarettes come into New York, that if you look at the cigarette tax, there's no tax paid for it when there should be. It comes in from the South. They truck it in here, and you can get it at a place that sells cigarettes, and there's no tax paid in New York. Why are we permitting it in here? Why is it even permitted? And why don't we shut down a store that sells cigarettes and don't have a New York State tax on it? Because that's a problem.
Well, that's what we're doing people are trying to stop flavored tobacco. And my attitude is, you know what? Let's continue the campaign to say all smoking is bad for you. But then when you come out and you say, well, you can smoke pot, but you can't smoke a hookah, you can't smoke a cigar, you can't smoke menthol cigarettes. I mean, to me, that's ridiculous. And all you do is you promote the black market where everybody buys this item that are out of compliance, that are more dangerous, that are untaxed, and then you put legitimate businesses out of business, and you promote this Wild West type of market. And, you know, we've gone through this with alcohol prohibition and other forms. Mm-hmm. You know, so my attitude, I stood against it. And I said, you know what, let's keep everything legitimate. Let's get rid of all the illegal sales. Let's really monitor it in a better way. And then, you know, let's continue campaigns to say, you know, drugs are wrong for you, and alcohol too much is wrong for you, and gambling too much is wrong for you. But, you know, we've become a society where, you know, we've taken the position of, you know what, you're free to do what you want. Fine, free to do what you want. We're going to continue to warn you about the risk. But at the same time, let's leave everything where it's in the open, it's taxed, it's legitimate, it's monitored. And there isn't
except the problem in society, I don't know if it's happened in Yonkers. I don't think it has. But I know in New York City, for example, there are places where you can now buy marijuana and other drugs legally, but it's not legal because the store doesn't have the certification to do that. They're not authorized, but they're there. So how is it that it's permitted? Because
well,
I don't know
that. it is. It's widespread, and now the big thing is businesses that are saying, well, I applied for a license, and why should everybody around me be? Yeah, and it's a big issue. And the New York City Police Department and state government will acknowledge that it's not an easy task to go and try to monitor all this so-called illegal activity. You know, and we understood. I mean, once they legalize,
if you got a store, and the point is the cops are on the beat, they should stop by a store. Oh, you're selling drugs. You're selling this item. You're selling that item. Where's your license? Why can't they check? What else have they got to do? This is proactive work. And the point is that if they don't have the license, they need to be fined. And if they don't have the license on hand, they need to be fined for that as well. And if they could show up, they should get a citation, and they better show up in court to say, where is your citation that gave you the authority to open up this store?
And once there's compliance.
And even the landlord. Why did the landlord accept something if they don't know if you're legitimately allowed to even open up a store like that? Remember their designation. You can open up a laundromat, but in certain cases, you're not allowed to open up a laundromat. You know, I mean, this is so simple. Yep. But we allow all these loopholes, and for what reason is beyond me? Because it only hurts society overall. That's the beauty of you. In the assembly, because you know all these con games, you know all these tricks, you've been there, you've lived it, you grew up in a poor home, but you got the credentials from your mom and your dad, and mostly your mom, and the bottom line is, because you lost your father, I understand, at a very early age, thank God for her, because it just is what it is.
I always appreciate the opportunity, and it's always a great discussion, and I just love the fact that you and I can talk about local and state and federal, international. You know, it's good discussion, because you know we try to talk from the heart, we talk from experience, and you know, and hopefully, you know, that type of dialogue is helpful to anyone listening, because whether you sometimes agree with the issues or not, at least from my end, and I appreciate that you have the same approach. We try to look at any issue or concern from a very broad range, where we try to show respect for everyone and try to see where there's common grounds. You know, whether we're talking crime, healthcare, education. You know, it's always crucial to have a broad-minded approach, and that's how I legislate. Monday, we're going back to Albany. Okay. We're going to do extenders. We're going to make sure state employees get paid. And at the same time, we'll continue to focus on whether it's bail reform, a housing initiative, and of course, you know, making sure for me that Yonkers and Yonkers schools get the most funding that they need, so that there's no layoffs and we can continue to work hard. But happy Passover, a happy Good Friday,
Easter, and happy Ramadan. And happy Ramadan too.
That's right. Joyous and healthy. And I always say the glass is always half full. So to everybody listening, nothing is more important than attitude in anything we do in life. And to have an attitude that's positive brings us a long way in the right direction. So let's enter this holiday season and enjoy our family, stay positive, and focus on our well-being.
Absolutely. Well, listen, to all the best to you. Enjoy the weekend, and we'll speak soon.
Sounds good. Always a pleasure. Enjoy.
Thank you, sir. Be well. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than New York State Assembly Member Nader Sage, who represents the city of Yonkers, 85% of it. But he's the only individual on the assembly the entirety of the district that he represents is one city, so one community, which I guess would make it easier than the different demeanor in different communities. But Yonkers is not an easy place. And Yonkers is really quite unique because we have so many different communities within the city, and there's a different demeanor and attitude in different sections of the city, which I guess is like every place. But it's all very, very fascinating, always, always interesting the way things work. Okay, so let's see if we can move on to a couple of other things. I wanted to check this out with you. Bear with me a moment. One second. Okay, let's see if I can get this. One second. There's a lot of news that's coming out there. It turns out that Biden's proposal, President Biden's proposal, would bar schools from enacting outright bans on trans athletes. This is fascinating. It seems that schools and colleges across the United States would be forbidden from enacting outright bans on transgender athletes under a proposal released today. It was yesterday by the Biden administration, but teams could create some limits in certain cases, for example, to ensure fairness. Well, whatever that term means, fairness. Well, the proposed rule sends a political counterpunch toward a wave of Republican-led states that have sought to ban trans athletes from competing in school sports that align with their gender identities. So if finalized, the proposal would become enshrined as a provision of Title IX, the landmark gender equity legislation enacted in 1972. So it must undergo a lengthy approval process, however, and it's almost certain to face challenges. So while opponents sharply criticized the proposal, some advocates for transgender athletes were concerned that it did not go far enough. So the proposal comes on the same day that the Supreme Court said a 12-year-old transgender girl in West Virginia can continue competing on her middle school track and cross-country teams while legal battles over the state's transgender law continue. So the law bans transgender athletes from female teams. All told, at least 16 states now have bans in effect covering at least high school interscholastic sports. Some also extend to intramural, club, or college sports. Enforcement of bans in at least three other states has been put on hold by courts, and one more has adopted a ban that doesn't take effect until July. So under the Educational Department's proposed rule, no school or college that receives federal funding would be allowed to impose a, quote, one-size-fits-all, end quote, policy that categorically bans trans students from playing on sports teams consistent with their gender identity. So such policies would be considered a violation of Title IX. Still, the proposal leaves room for schools to develop team eligibility rules that could ultimately result in restrictions around trans athletes' participation. And that would be allowed only if it serves important educational objectives such as fairness in competition and reduction of injury risks. So these are some of the concerns for sure. So we'll see what else is going on. Bear with me a moment here. One second. Now, one moment here. All right, let's look at what's going on in the Middle East. Evidently, two have been killed in the West Bank after Israel strikes Lebanon and Gaza. So out of Jerusalem, we hear that Israel unleashed rare airstrikes on Lebanon and continued bombarding the Gaza Strip on Friday, an escalation that sparked fears of a broader conflict following days of violence over Jerusalem's most sensitive holy site. So later on Friday, there were signs that both sides were trying to keep the hostilities in check. fighting on Israel's northern and southern borders subsided after dawn, and midday prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem passed peacefully. But a Palestinian shooting attack in the Israeli-occupied West Bank killed two women near an Israeli settlement just hours later, a grim reminder of the combustible situation. The early morning Israeli strikes followed an unusually large rocket barrage fired at Israel from southern Lebanon, what an analyst described as the most serious cross-border violence since Israel's 2006 war with Lebanon's Hezbollah militants. Well, the violence erupted after Israeli police raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem earlier this week, sparking unrest in the contested capital and outrage across the Arab world. So the Israeli strike seems designed to avoid drawing in the Iran-backed Shiite group, which Israel considers its most immediate threat. The Israeli military said its warplanes struck infrastructure belonging to Palestinian militants that it accused of firing the nearly three dozen rockets that slammed into open areas and northern Israeli towns on Thursday. Nonetheless, the Israeli military said it believed the Palestinian militants acted with the knowledge of Hezbollah, which holds sway over much of southern Lebanon. And there were no reports of serious casualties, but several residents of the southern Lebanese town of Halili, including Syrian refugees, said they were lightly wounded. Quote, "I immediately gathered my wife and children and got them out of the house," said Halili resident Bilal Suleiman, who was jolted awake by the bombing. A flock of sheep was also killed when Israeli missiles struck an open field near the Palestinian refugee camp of Rashidiya, according to an Associated Press photographer. And other airstrikes hit a bridge and power transformer in the nearby town of Ma'aliya and damaged an irrigation system providing water to orchards in the area. In the Gaza Strip, Israel's military pounded what it said were weapons production sites and underground tunnels belonging to Hamas, the militant group, using the Palestinian enclave. The residents inspected the damage left after Israeli strikes, including to a children's hospital in Gaza City, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. So after the retaliatory strikes, Israelis living along the southern border returned home from bomb shelters. Most missiles were managed to cross into Israeli territory, hit open areas, but one landed in the nearby town of Sderot, sending shrapnel slicing into a house. There were no reports of casualties on either side of the southern border. So that's what's going on over there. Now bear with me a second. A couple of other things to also look into. Bear with me a moment here. All right, one moment. All right. One moment here. Well, this is new news with regard to Ukraine. Evidently, the update seems that Russia is gaining ground in Bakhmut, so says the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom Defense Ministry said that Russia has, quote, regained some momentum, end quote, in the battle for Bakhmut. Meanwhile, U.S. media reported that secret plans of a spring offensive in Ukraine have been leaked online. Well, the United Kingdom's Ministry of Defense, the MOD, said that Russian forces have regained some momentum in the battle for Bakhmut in recent days, according to an intelligence update published on Friday. Well, the eastern Ukrainian city remains at the heart of a grinding battle of attrition as Russian forces attempt to capture this strategically important location. Well, a Ukrainian military official told Reuters, a news agency, that Kyiv's forces are continuing to hold out in Bakhmut on Friday. Eastern Military Command spokesperson Zhery Sherevatsky acknowledged, however, that Ukrainian troops were facing a, quote, difficult, end quote, situation. The Minister of Defense's latest intelligence briefing said that Russia had made more gains and, quote, has now highly likely advanced into the town center, end quote. Russian forces have gained control of the west bank of the Bakhmuta River, and a key supply route for Ukraine to the west of the city was, quote, likely severely threatened, end quote, the ministry said. It was probable that Russian regular forces, which likely included airborne elements, had reinforced the area while Russian artillery was being used more effectively in the area, the Minister of Defense had said. Well, the briefing also mentioned that there was a, quote, realistic probability, end quote, that the leadership from Russian private mercenary company, the Wagner Group, and Russian military commanders had halted an ongoing feud and had managed to improve cooperation. On Thursday, the Wagner Group's Yevgeny Prigozhin said there was no indication that Ukrainian forces were about to abandon the city of Bakhmut, although Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky had raised the prospect of a possible withdrawal should defending forces come at risk of being encircled by Russian forces. Well, China and France are committing to promote peace in Ukraine. She asked the parties to meet each other halfway. Well, China and France said their countries support all efforts to restore peace in Ukraine on the basis of international law and principles of the United Nations Charter, and oppose armed forces, armed attacks on nuclear power plants, a joint statement reported by the official Xinhua news agency said. Chinese leader Xi Jinping, in a separate statement by the Chinese Foreign Ministry, called for a political settlement to end the war in Ukraine. He added all parties in the conflict ought to meet each other halfway, quote unquote, to create conditions to arrive at the settlement, according to the ministry. China and France, in their joint statement, reaffirmed their commitment to promote nonproliferation of nuclear weapons, nuclear disarmament, and the peaceful use of nuclear energy. France-based aerospace giant Airbus announced it reached a deal with a Chinese firm to sell 50 helicopters on Macron's final day in Beijing. Both countries are willing to cooperate to solve the financial hardships of developing economies and emphasize support for a rules-based multilateral trading system with the World Trade Organization. China would attend a climate summit in Paris in June, while France would attend the Third Belt and Road Forum hosted by China, according to the statement. French President Emmanuel Macron and European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen arrived in Beijing early this week for meetings with Chinese officials and leader Xi Jinping as the war in Ukraine drags on. Macron told Xi and von der Leyen he was, quote, convinced that China has a major role to play in building peace, end quote, while she said he was willing to work with France and the international community to, quote, avoid taking actions that would further worsen the crisis or cause it to spiral out of control, end quote. Cyprus is going to offer Ukraine mine clearance training. It seems that Defense Minister of Cyprus, Michalis Georgias, has offered Ukraine landmine clearance training as part of the humanitarian assistance that it holds dear. Quote, we will host personnel which will handle demining and detection of mines, Gail Gallis told Cypriot broadcaster Sigma TV. Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, is on a visit to the island and is due to tour the locations where training will take place. Cyprus has been split since 1974, when Turkish troops invaded the north, responding to a coup orchestrated by supporters of the union with Greece. A 116-mile dividing line across Cyprus was riddled with minefields until the two sides began clearing operations over the past decade with the assistance of the United Nations. Well, thousands of crimes registered in Germany are related to the Ukraine war, so says a report. German publication Neue Osnabrücker Zeitung has reported that since the beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, around 6,000 criminal offenses relating to the war in Ukraine have been registered by German authorities. Figures from the Federal Criminal Police Office, the BKA, were cited with crimes including damage to property, insults, threats, and physical assault. The newspaper reported that in the first 2 weeks of the war, most of the crimes were against Russia's invasion. But over the past few months, the majority of crimes reported had an, quote, anti-Ukrainian intention. The publication reported that in instances of damage to property where graffiti was sprayed on walls, recorded offenses included expressed sympathy for a warring party. Crimes that expressed an anti-war sentiment were also included. Then there's a classified NATO-US-backed spring offensive plans have been leaked. So reports say, secret documents detailing U.S. and NATO plans to assist Ukraine in preparation for a spring offensive have been leaked on social media, according to a New York Times report. Quote, we are aware of the reports on social media posts, and the U.S. Defense Department is reviewing the matter, Deputy Pentagon Press Secretary Sabrina Singh had said. The U.S. newspaper reported that the documents were spread on Twitter and Telegram. They reportedly contained details pertaining to weapons deliveries and the strength of certain battalions, along with other sensitive material. According to the report, one of the documents was at least 5 weeks old, while the most recent was dated March 1st. NATO allies have committed to support Ukraine in the face of Russia's invasion with provisions of arms, ammunition, and training. Well, more on the war in Ukraine. It seems that French President Emmanuel Macron and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen have traveled to China to push Beijing to get Russia to the negotiating table, and those efforts are detailed, which we read already. bear with me 1 second here. Now, this is really very interesting. It seems that there's an Indian alternative to TikTok and has millions of users. Chinese apps like TikTok are banned in India. MOJ or Josh, J-O-S-H, have emerged as popular alternatives with comparable functionality. So this is going to be really, really fascinating, to say the least. So if you're interested, MOJ or JOSH have emerged as popular alternatives with comparable functionality. So that's going to be very, very interesting. And so we'll see where that goes. Now, 1 second here. One moment here. Now, this is fascinating, actually. Artificial intelligence supposedly is able to detect Alzheimer's. So to treat Alzheimer's successfully, early detection is key. U.S. researchers have found a way to discover a predisposition for the disease during routine checks with the help of artificial intelligence. So that's something to really think about, which is fascinating. Bear with me a moment. 1 second. 1 second here. All right, I want to go to 1 minute. Okay, gotta go over to some other sites. 1 minute here. All right, let's see if we can get here. All right, 1 second. One second here. One moment. Where am I here? Okay, this is really quite interesting. This is with regard to the Abraham Accords. It seems that Palestinian leaders don't realize that the region is changing. Palestinian human rights lawyer and former diplomat Hays al-Omari, a prominent advocate of the two-state solution in negotiations with Israel, gave a lengthy interview on a recent visit to Paris. He gave it to France 24. In this last of three-part series, he discussed the Abraham Accords, which saw the normalization of diplomatic relations between Israel and several Arab countries. Hays al-Omari has long been a key player in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, acting as a Palestinian negotiator at the 2000 Camp David summit convened by then-U.S. President Bill Clinton, and again at the 2001 Taba summit in Egypt. He was an advisor to Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas until 2006. With the peace process stalled since 2014, he now works as a senior fellow at the Washington Institute's Irwin Levy Family Program on the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship. Al-Omari was in Paris 2 weeks ago to unveil the Whispered in Gaza project, a series of short animated films based on the testimonies of Palestinians living in Gaza at the French National Assembly. After speaking about the political situation in the occupied West Bank, under the unbroken rule of the 87-year-old Abbas and the despair of Palestinian youth in the first two of his three-part interview series, Al-Omari discusses the Abraham Accords mediated by the United States and signed in 2020. So while the Palestinian cause remains popular among the Arab people, the signatories of the Accords have opened a new era for the region. Has this come at the expense of the Palestinian people? I don't believe that the signatories of the Accords have turned their back on Palestinians. We are witnessing a new way of doing politics in the Middle East, centered in the Gulf. The Arab countries that are undertaking this new approach did this to pursue their national interests, and they have every right to do so. I think the Palestinian leaders don't realize that the region is changing. They still live in the past. They still think that the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the former Egyptian president who championed pan-Arabism, will come back. They will not. Those good old days of ideologies such as pan-Arabism, pan-Islamism, and Nasserism are slowly disappearing and no longer dominate the region. This is the reality, and in this regard, Palestinians need to ask themselves if they can benefit from the new order when everyone else is focused on maximizing their own interests, or are they going to remain on the sidelines and watch as history passes them by? I believe that there is a way for Palestinians to profit from the situation. As a former Palestinian negotiator, I can tell you that when we needed to effectively put pressure on the Israeli government, we call on Washington first, of course, and then Amman and Cairo. Why? Because the Arab countries that maintain diplomatic relations with Israel have the leverage to pressurize the nation's leaders. And now other Arab countries have also have leverage. Let's not forget that the United Arab Emirates have signed the Abraham Accords on condition that the Israeli government cease annexation of Palestinian territories. So in a certain way, they've already delivered to the Palestinians. Palestinian leaders now have the choice of meeting with the leaders of these countries to express their respect of the decision to establish formal ties with Israel and seek out ways to profit from the situation, or do what they're currently doing, which is condemning the new order and refusing to engage. So how can the Palestinians benefit from the Accords? If they choose to engage, they will obtain strengthened political support from the Arab countries. As we saw recently, the United Arab Emirates was willing to sponsor a United Nations Security Council resolution in support of the Palestinians in their fight against the construction and expansion of Israeli settlements. More than political support, there are also possibilities for economic benefits. Here's an example. 2 years ago, Jordan and the United Arab Emirates signed a deal to address each other's shortcomings. Jordan is a regional leader in clean energy production thanks to solar power plants, yet remains one of the nation's, one of the world's most water-deprived countries. The deal was then to build solar power plants in Jordan and desalinization stations in Israel. Editor's note, Israel is a world leader in desalinization, but is lacking in energy, particularly in the south of the country. Swapping solar energy and water so that the needs of both countries are met. Well, the United Arab Emirates, meanwhile, financed the project, knowing full well that all surpluses sold would profit themselves. It's a win-win situation. The Palestinians would have been a perfect candidate for this kind of deal, as there are many project deals such as those that they could participate in. There is much to gain, but they need to make the choice of joining. The region is changing, and the Abraham Accords are here to stay. And we can see that despite the current tension between the Israeli government and its Arab counterparts, they continue to develop economic and security ties. Now, regarding the state of Israeli politics, do the Accords help restrain the most right-wing Israeli government in history? At the end of the day, the Israeli considerations will be primarily domestic politics, like all countries on Earth. Nevertheless, with the Abraham Accords countries, today Israel has to think twice before taking certain actions. I can even tell you that according to an Israeli official source, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli diplomatic offices, as well as the Israeli intelligence community, are all very sensitive to criticism from the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco. They almost got used to criticism from Egypt and Jordan. They don't take it seriously that much. But due to the popularity of the Abraham Accords in Israel, when these new partners criticize the Israelis, listen. So it creates a counter pressure. We know, for example, that Benjamin Netanyahu held back his Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, when the latter wanted to take more provocative steps in Jerusalem. Prime Minister Sfeir of the United Arab Emirates, which has rapidly developed strong ties with Israel, cutting the relations that is getting him to really pressure his minister to refrain from some of these provocative actions. He doesn't always succeed. He may not always want to succeed, but Israel is finding itself under a new pressure, without which the extremist elements of its government would be much stronger and much more assertive. From a broader perspective, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which once stood at the center of international relations, seems to have been relegated to a regional issue. Do you agree? Has this helped facilitate a reconciliation between the signatories of the Accords and Israel? Nowadays, the international community considers certain issues to be much more important, such as the war in Ukraine, China's expanding power, Iran's nuclear threats, not to mention the various crises in Yemen, Syria, and Libya. In terms of immediate risks, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has thus been eclipsed by much more risky conflicts. At a certain point in the 90s, up to the early 2000s, there was a sense of opportunity, the idea that if you invest politically in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you might get results. Today, there is no sense of possibility. The Western world and regional players have understood that Palestinians are too weak to sign a deal, and the Israelis are not interested anyways in such a deal. Political leaders are hence looking for an opportunity elsewhere, and that's why the Abraham Accords are so popular. If you were a leader, would you want to engage in something that will fail? Even so, the world has moved on. In the end, it's up to Palestinians and Israelis to recapture the world's attention on the issue of their conflict. Ironically, the extremist and sometimes racist policies of the current Israeli government attract a lot of scrutiny and generated many reactions internationally. The recent summoning of the Israeli ambassador to the United States Department of State in Washington was almost unprecedented. Even Israel's new allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, have begun criticizing the nation all the time. It's one thing to ignore this conflict, but there is a collapse, especially around Jerusalem. It can have spillover effects throughout the Arab world, throughout the Islamic world, so it's a reminder that the issue cannot be completely ignored. bear with me a second. One second, I want to check this out. Let's look at this for a moment. Now, this is another issue. The question is whether the situation, one second. Let me just see if I got this right. One moment. I don't know what went on here. I need to see if this has come through. Oh, this is not coming through for some reason. Okay. All right, it is just what it is. So bear with me a moment. So I'm going to move on. One moment here. I wanted to go over this with you. Okay. Evidently, two Democrats in the Tennessee House have evidently been expelled. Out of Nashville, Tennessee, we hear that in an extraordinary act of political retaliation, Tennessee Republicans on Thursday expelled two Democratic lawmakers from the state legislature for their role in a protest calling for more gun control in the aftermath of a deadly school shooting in Nashville. A third Democrat was narrowly spared by a one-vote margin. Now, the split votes drew accusations of racism, with lawmakers ousting Representative Justin Jones and Justin Pearson, who are both black, while Representative Gloria Johnson, who is white, survived the vote on her expulsion. Well, Republican leadership denied that race was a fact, however, or factor. The visitors' gallery exploded in screams and boos following the final vote. After sitting quietly for hours and hushing anyone who cried out during the proceedings, people broke into chants of shame and fascists. Well, banishment is a move the chamber has used only a handful of times since the Civil War. Most state legislatures have the power to expel members, but it is generally reserved as a punishment for lawmakers accused of serious misconduct, not used as a weapon against political opponents. GOP leaders said that Thursday's actions were necessary to avoid setting a precedent that lawmakers' disruptions of House proceedings through protest would be tolerated. Republican Representative Gino Bulso said that the three Democrats had, quote, effectively conducted a mutiny, end quote. At an evening rally, Jones and Pearson pledged to be back at the Capitol next week advocating for change. Quote, rather than pass laws that will address red flags and banning assault weapons and universal background checks, they passed resolutions to expel their colleagues, Jones said, and they think that the issue is over. We'll see you on Monday, he said. Jones, Pearson, and Johnson joined in protesting last week as hundreds of demonstrators packed the Capitol to call for passage of gun control measures. As the protesters filled galleries, The three approached the front of the house chamber with a bullhorn and participated in a chant. The scene unfolded days after the shooting of the Covenant School, a private Christian school where six children were killed, including three children. Pearson told reporters on Thursday that in carrying out the protest, the three had broken, quote, a house rule because we're fighting for kids who are dying from gun violence and people in our communities who want to see an end to the proliferation of weaponry in our communities, end quote. Johnson, a retired teacher, said her concern about school shootings was personal, recalling a day in 2008 when students came running toward her out of the cafeteria because a student had just been shot and killed. The trauma on those faces, you will never, ever forget, she said. Thousands of people flocked to the Capitol to support Jones, Pearson, and Johnson on Thursday, cheering and chanting outside the House chamber loudly enough to drown out the proceedings. The trio held hands as they walked into the floor, onto the floor, and Pearson raised a fist during the Pledge of Allegiance. Offered a chance to defend himself before the vote, Jones said that the GOP responded to the shooting with a different kind of attack. Quote, we called for you all to ban assault weapons, and you respond with an assault on democracy, he said. Jones vowed that even if expelled, he would action on guns. I'll be out there with the people every week demanding that you act, he said. Bolso accused Jones of acting with, quote, disrespect, end quote, and showing, quote, no remorse, end quote. Quote, he does not even recognize that what he did was wrong, end quote, Bolso said. Quote, so not to expel him would simply invite him and his colleagues to engage in mutiny on the House floor, end quote. The two expelled lawmakers may not be gone for long. County commissions in their districts get to pick replacements to serve until a special election can be scheduled, and they could opt to choose Jones and Pearson. The two also would be eligible to run in those races. Under the Tennessee Constitution, lawmakers cannot be expelled for the same offense twice. During this discussion, Republican Representative Sabi Kumar advised Jones to be more collegial and less focused on race. Quote, you have a lot to offer, but offer it in a vein where people are accepting of your ideas, end quote, Kumar had said. Jones said he did not intend to assimilate in order to be accepted. Quote, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to make a change for my community, end quote, he replied. Fielding questions from lawmakers, Johnson reminded them that she did not raise her voice, nor did she use the bullhorn, as did the other two, both of whom are new lawmakers and among the youngest members of the chamber. But Johnson also suggested race was likely a factor on why Jones and Pearson were ousted, but not her, telling reporters it, quote, might have to do with the color of our skin, end quote. That notion was echoed by State Senator London Lamar, a Democrat representing Memphis. Lawmakers, quote, expelled the two black men and kept the white woman, end quote, Lamar, a black woman, said via Twitter, quote, the racism that is on display today, end quote. Wow. Anyway, however, House Speaker Cameron Sexton, a Republican who voted to expel all three, denied that race was at play and said that Johnson's arguments might have swayed other members. Quote, our members literally didn't look at the ethnicity of the members up for expulsion, end quote, Majority Leader William Lamberth had added. He alleged Jones and Pearson were trying to incite a riot last week, while Johnson was more subdued. In Washington, President Joe Biden also was critical of the expulsion, calling them, quote, shocking, undemocratic, and without precedent, end quote. Rather than, quote, rather than debating the merits of the issue of gun control, these Republican lawmakers have chosen to punish, silence, and expel duly elected representatives of the people of Tennessee, end quote, by the said in the statement. So before the expulsion votes, House members debated more than 20 bills, including a school safety proposal requiring public and private schools to submit building safety plans to the state. The bill did not address gun control, sparking criticism from some Democrats that it only addresses a symptom and not the cause of school shootings. Past expulsion votes have taken place under distinctly different circumstances. In 2019, lawmakers faced pressure to expel former Republican Representative David Byrd over accusations of sexual misconduct dated to when he was a high school basketball coach 3 decades earlier. Republicans declined to take action, pointing out that he was reelected as the allegation surfaced. Byrd retired last year. Last year, the state Senate expelled Democrat Katrina Robinson after she was convicted of using about $3,400 in federal grant money on wedding expenses instead of her nursing school. Before that, state lawmakers last ousted a House Speaker in 2016 when the chamber voted 70-2 to remove Republican Representative Jeremy Durham over allegations of improper sexual conduct, contact with at least 22 women during his 4 years in office. Unbelievable. Oh, God. We have a few minutes, so let's see if we can cover this for you as well. The ex-Scottish leader's husband has been arrested in a party's finance probe. Out of London, we hear that the husband of former Scottish Prime Minister and Scottish National Party leader Nicola Sturgeon was released from police custody on Wednesday evening without being charged after his arrest in a party finance probe, British media reported. Police Scotland did not identify Peter Moore as the 58-year-old man arrested, quote, in connection with the ongoing investigation into the funding and finances of the Scottish National Party, end quote. However, Britain's Press Association, the BBC, and others reported it was Moore. Scottish police have been investigating how £600,000 and $750,000 earmarked for a Scottish independence campaign was spent. Morrill resigned on March 18th as the party's chief executive as a bitter contest to replace Durgan was unfolding against the backdrop of the police investigation and a controversy about the party's declining membership. He held the position for more than 20 years. In a Wednesday night update, police said the man arrested in the morning was questioned by detectives and, quote, released without charge pending further investigation, end quote. The police force said that officers searched a number of locations as part of the probe and would send a report to Scottish prosecutors. Now, Sturgeon, 52, said in a statement to the BBC and British TV channel Sky News that he had, quote, no prior knowledge of Police Scotland's action or intentions, end quote, when Morrill was arrested. He plans to cooperate with police if required, her spokesperson had said. Scottish National Party said it had been cooperating fully in the investigation and would continue to do so, but that it was inappropriate to comment further. Sturgeon abruptly announced her resignation in February after 8 years as party leader and First Minister of Scotland's semi-autonomous government. Sturgeon said at the time that serving well was knowing when to make way for someone else. Quote, in my head and in my heart, I know that that time is now, end quote, she said. Quote, it's time for me, for my party and my country, end quote. And Deputy Scottish Labour leader Jackie Bailey said the arrest was, quote, deeply concerning, end quote, and called on Sturgeon and her successor, Humza Yousaf, to, quote, urgently state what they knew and when, end quote. Yousaf said that he had not had a role in party finances and vowed to be transparent under his leadership. The investigation could further harm the Scottish National Party's political fortunes, which saw its poll numbers droop during the acrimonious election to replace Sturgeon. Quote, it certainly doesn't do us any good, end quote, Yusuf said when asked if Morrill's arrest would hurt the party. Quote, people still will have questions. There will be some concerns. Our party membership will have concerns too, end quote. Now, John Kuotis, a political professor at the University of Strathclyde, said that the impact of the arrest on the party and Sturgeon's legacy would depend on whether prosecutors file charges, but it's already dealt a setback to her successor, who just took office last week. As of today, there's no Yusuf bounce. It's the opposite. It's gone down, Curtis had said. This doesn't make it easier for him to start off on the front foot, and he probably needs to start off at the front foot. Finn's arrest undoubtedly refueled speculation on the reason Sturgeon unexpectedly resigned, but it's not known what she was aware of when she stepped down, Curtis had said. Yusuf said he did not believe the investigation into party finances had caused Sturgeon to resign. Quote, I believe her very much when she says how exhausted she was, Yusuf had said. I think that anybody who watched her over the course of the pandemic during those daily briefings day after day, I think anybody could understand how exhausting that is. Sturgeon had led Scotland since 2014 when Scots voted to remain part of the United Kingdom. While the referendum was billed as a once-in-a-generation decision on independence, Sturgeon and her party had pushed for a new vote, arguing that Britain's departure from the European Union had changed the ground rules. The Scottish government wants to hold a referendum next October with the question, quote, should Scotland be an independent country, end quote. The United Kingdom government in London refuses to approve a vote, saying the question was settled in a 2014 referendum that saw Scottish voters reject independence by a margin of 55% to 45%. Morrell's resignation came just before his wife left office and as three members of Scottish Parliament fought a bruising contest to replace her. The Scottish National Party had publicly denied a newspaper report that its membership had plunged from more than 100,000 to just over 70,000 in the past year before admitting it was true. Morrell accepted responsibility and quit, saying that, quote, while there was no intent to mislead, I accept that this has been the outcome, end quote. Police cars were parked outside the couple's Glasgow home on Wednesday, and a blue tent had been erected by officers in front of the house. Officers were also stationed outside the Scottish National Party headquarters in Edinburgh, and several police vans were parked near the building. The presence of police at both locations created a bad image for the party, as well as Sturgeon and her husband, Curtis had said. Quote, perhaps the money given to the party for one purpose was used for another, he said. Quote, it's probably not the world's biggest crime, but it's not a good look if it gets pursued further. So that's the situation. There's only about 5 minutes left, so it's really time for us to consider just simply saying goodbye. I want to thank you all for being with us today. What a pleasure, as always. So, thank you very much for being with us. Hopefully you'll join us on Monday. Have a great weekend. The best of those continuing to celebrate Passover or Pesach, Ramadan that's coming up, and, of course, the Easter Sunday that's coming up as well in the Orthodox Church. And that's it. I guess that's everything. I don't know what else there is. So I want to thank you again for being with us, for sure. Let me go back here and simply say goodbye. Speak to you on Monday. Goodbye.